This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
In a way, mental touch as well, like personal connection, conversations with friends, like deep conversations, connection, that kind of stuff. I mean, but I would start with kind of just, you know, breath and touch, as woo as that sounds. And I know people is from a neuroscientist and a doctor, they want something that's a little more, maybe sexy in a way. But I think it's just really getting into sensation, because a lot of stress is basically a separation of your mind and your body. We go up into our heads and we start getting this dopamine addiction, and we lose that sense of our body. And then time goes by. It feels like, man, it's like 2 months have gone by. I haven't really noticed. You know, it's just not being in your body. It's not being in that sense of sensation and making the intention to stay with sensation, even, and especially if that sensation is uncomfortable. You know, if you feel sad or whatever, it's okay to feel sad. You don't have to run and you know, go to your phone all the time. You know, it's just being able to metabolize that feeling and being able to stay in it. And it's hard, you know, when you get into depression and anxiety, that's a pathological perseverance in it. But in general, it just kind of doesn't allow us to stay. We don't allow ourselves to stay present in any emotion, good, bad, or indifferent, because we're so used to what's next, what's next, what's next. So the bottom line is that we're in this dopamine-driven situation and we're not actually staying in sensation. We're always looking for something new, something better, which is, you know, part of our human wiring. But unfortunately, it makes us very unhappy in the long term.
You mentioned the importance of touch and putting our hand over our heart, and as woo-woo and as maybe odd as it may sound to somebody. A lot of times people will take quiet time, like first thing in the morning, and connect to their breath, connect to themselves. Is this what you would recommend, like doing this like first thing in the morning?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people do meditation and that kind of thing, but I think we totally miss this aspect of self-touch. You know, one of the things that I work on with the people that, you know, I'm an anxiety specialist that struggle with anxiety. It's like, where is this alarm? I call anxiety alarm because that's what I believe it is. Where is this alarm in your body? And some people say, well, it's up in my throat or in my chest or in my belly or whatever. It's like, okay, what does it feel like? Well, kind of hot, it's kind of sharp, it feels like a pressure, feels like a pain. It's like, okay, can you put your hand over that area? Can you connect with it? Because to go another step into woo is, I believe a lot of people that have chronic anxiety have a younger version of themselves that manifest in their body. So for me, it's in my solar plexus, and there's a lot of neuroscience behind this, you know, like the insular cortex in the brain sort of mediates this sort of top down, bottom up kind of part. It's kind of like the way station where we feel and think at the same place. And I think that we create these body memories, these implicit memories, unconscious memories that are mediated by this part of the brain and the amygdala. But the insula is one of those things that it's kind of like, where do you feel something in your body? Your insula is kind of what metabolizes that. It's like, oh, I feel when you get broken up with or something, you're going through a breakup, the insula creates that feeling of heartache in your chest. So one of my work is to try and, like, can we access that insular cortex when you are feeling anxious? Can we change the sensation? Can we accept the sensation? Can we put our hand over it? Can we connect with it? Because I think that is the younger version of us. And I realize this does sound woo, and as a medical doctor and neuroscientist, I want to have a seizure sometimes when I talk about this stuff. But it's really important to connect with ourselves through self-touch that we don't do. It's not like meditation's pretty common. Yoga's pretty common. But it's really getting that sensation and connecting with that sensation, because, you know, the alarm sensation in your body could well be that younger version of you trying to get your attention.
Is there any kind of like protocol you would recommend to somebody who's feeling like anxious in the moment? They're feeling a bit trapped. Is it just putting their hand over their heart and breathing? I know we talked about like the nostril breathing and the exhale, I think the last time. Like, how do we blend those things together?
Well, it's getting out of your head, really, because I think what happens with stress is we try and think our way out of a feeling problem. It doesn't work. it just doesn't work. But it doesn't stop us from trying to do that. I mean, I think as children, the only place we had to go if our parents weren't, you know, there for us in a way, was our heads, because staying in your body was just too painful. Like that's where all the pain is stored. So you go up into your head, you start overthinking, you start becoming hypervigilant, that kind of thing. And it's a habit that we take into adulthood that we don't even realize that we've been caught in our head for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years sometimes. So it's like, can you make the conscious intention to move out of your head, because your worries aren't going to solve anything. In fact, they're just going to make you more uncomfortable. Can you take the opposite choice and go into your body rather than trying to stay in your head? Now, your body's probably going to be uncomfortable because this is where you store all the old alarm. So initially, it may feel more uncomfortable to go into your body, but I think there is this kind of overwhelming sense that when you put your hand over the area where you feel your stress in your body, there is this sense of connection that's there, and it immediately helps people. And it's like, okay, I'm on the right track here. I'm on the right track with this sensation and tracking this in my body and slowing it down too. Like our minds go so quickly. Our mind goes so fast that it just outruns our body most of the time. And it's like, can you slow your mind down enough so that it can actually join up with your body? Because one of the things I say about anxiety, chronic anxiety, is that it's a separation of your adult self and your child self, because the adult in you doesn't want to go back to the child because that's where all our pain is stored. And it's a separation from our mind, from our body. So when we connect our mind and our body back together again, we actually create this fertile ground to actually metabolize the trauma, metabolize the sadness, metabolize the pain, rather than just going into our head, which basically just suspends it. The pain is in suspended animation. As soon as you go into your head, you never actually make a dent in that pain because you're too busy up in your head. If the issue is, you know, stuck in your body and you're worrying around hypervigilant in your mind all the time, that part of your body never gets dealt with, and that pain never gets any sort of airtime. Never gets any connection. So of course it's not going to heal, and it's probably just going to get worse.
What would you say the biggest mistakes people make that might not be so obvious? Maybe these are subtle, that, you know, throughout the week actually increase their anxiety.
Well, just thinking more, just believing unconsciously that you're going to solve this problem. You know, if you're worried about your son or your daughter or your mom or your dad or whatever, worrying about it isn't going to do anything. In fact, it's just going to drag your physiology into the gutter. But if you can learn how to sort of go into your body and allow that sensation to be there, that discomfort about, like, I did a podcast about my oldest dog, Buddha. You know, he's kind of failing, so he may not last another 6 months or so. So it's one of those things where, can I go into that sensation in my body of what it's going to be like to lose him? And can I stay with it? Can I actually metabolize it rather than just overthink and go, well, you know, he's still doing okay. He's still doing well. You know, he'll probably be okay. That kind of stuff. Like, we know that we're just worrying, and we know that the worry doesn't actually solve anything. It just suspends things in suspended animation, and the pain is still there. So go at the pain directly. Allow the pain to be there. Metabolize the pain. And a lot of people who have, like, a partner, relative, parent, whatever, with a cancer diagnosis, they do a lot of the grieving before the person actually passes. And this is what I'm talking about. It's just basically metabolizing the angst that you're feeling rather than going up into your head and trying to explain why you should feel better.
Other than overthinking things or thinking that you can think your way out of a problem or think your way into a solution, is there anything that people should be doing that they're not doing? Maybe like daily exercise, movement?
Yeah, conscious movement for sure. Like, I think even, like, I have this little practice that I do sometimes, and I just basically move my hand and my breath. It's not, it looks a bit Tai Chi-ish and that kind of stuff, but it's basically, I just make it up. And anytime that you match your breath and your movement together, you start joining your mind and your body together. So it starts alleviating your stress right away. And when you move into your body and out of your head, you're starting to get to the root cause of the problem, instead of just, unfortunately, we're wired to believe that worry, unconsciously believe that worry is helpful. And it basically just traps us in more worry. So the more you can go into the sensation specifically of your body, even if it hurts, the more you can start actually processing and metabolizing the underlying cause of this problem in the first place, as opposed to just trying to numb it by, you know, overthinking.
On the other side of this is people can become, I think, passive, because we know we're talking about how to, like, not suppress, but mitigate stress, mitigate anxiety. And on the other side of all this, there's people that are feeling, you know, unmotivated, unable to focus, lazy, if you will. So how can people do the opposite if they're like trying to upregulate their nervous system a bit to be able to prime themselves to take action?
Well, this is hard, but get off social media for one. You know, it's just you're burned out your dopamine system. You know, we have this place in our brain called the ventral tegmental area that makes dopamine, one of them. And it squirts dopamine onto the nucleus accumbens, which is basically our motivation center. And if you create way too much dopamine all the time, you drop the bar, or actually you raise the bar into what's going to excite you. So if you're always excited all the time, when you drop into a normal baseline state, it's going to feel pretty lonely and bereft in there. So a lot of what happens, I think, is that we get so wrapped up in this dopamine-driven society that we forget about the sort of the more serotonin, the more here and now, kind of like the more awareness, the more presence. And if you don't spend a lot of time in presence, you're probably not going to want to spend a lot more time in presence, and you just keep going at this dopamine cycle. And you can only go at it for so long until it just starts to burn you out and you just feel, and this is what I'm seeing a lot in people, this thing called anhedonia, which is this, I don't feel pleasure in anything because they burned out their dopamine system, right? So you can start building it back up again by doing things like, you know, cold plunges, you know, putting your body in this sort of stressful thing where, you know, you can kind of recirculate some of the isness of life, like the feeling in life, even if it's uncomfortable. So I think we spend so much time avoiding discomfort and in through distraction, specifically with social media, is that we never really get a chance to feel anything anymore because we're always looking for the next hit. And after a while, you burn out that dopamine system and then you won't feel motivation for anything. And then that's a dangerous place to be in because there's not a whole lot of ways out of that other than doing the exact opposite, which is maybe getting into some meditation, going for walks, staying away from kind of like that immediate gratification all the time, and just retraining that system to build up, you know, the sense of life again. Because that's what I'm seeing with so many people is that they don't really have this joy in life. I don't see too many people that feel joy in life anymore.
So do you think that the only solution to this is similar to an elimination diet where you completely detox yourself from dopamine for a period of time and then start to reintroduce it into your life in a way that's healthy?
Yeah. Or, you know, just, you know, what do you like? What did you like when you were a kid? Like, did you like, you know, playing road hockey? Did you like riding your bike? Like, what is it that you liked to do when you were younger? And you're probably still like to do those things now. So start with the things that you know that you liked in the past and start reintroducing them. You know, start going on a bike ride, you know, every couple of days or whatever. Getting out of that mold of being in the house, being separate from other people, you know, connecting with other people. I mean, we used to have, you know, in the 70s and 80s, we used to have clubs, you know, car clubs and clubs, and people would join and meet together. And now, because we have everything we kind of desire in a way in on a computer screen, why would we go out of the house? You know, movie theaters aren't doing well anymore. Like all these things that used to get people out and get them feeling together and feeling connected. You know, I always get reminded of those starlings, you know, when you see those thousands of starlings and they're all moving in one direction, it looks like a big cloud. You know, there is this neural net that we believe forms from bird to bird, and they all move in the same thing. They're all almost sharing one nervous system. And I think on some level too, this is what happens with like soccer hooliganism and, you know, and football games and basketball games when crowds just go nuts, is that there's this wiring that occurs between human beings that we can't explain, but it's very powerful. And if we lose that connection with other people, we become depressed. And you know, what you and I have talked about before is we develop this us and them mentality where we only feel good when we're making them feel bad, when we're insulting them. And this is what social media is doing. This is why people will go on and just insult somebody, someone who says like, here's my flower arrangement that I did today. And it's like, why do you use roses? You know, like you're an idiot to use roses. Like, where is this coming from? And it's coming from the fact that people feel separate from other people. And it becomes ultimately because you feel separate from yourself. And when you're split from yourself, you're always looking for something to make yourself feel better. And usually the first thing you look for is like dopamine driven. It's not, you don't sort of look like, oh, okay, I'll just go down and watch the sunset and make myself feel better that way. It's like, I'll go on social media or I'll go do something that kind of, you know, involves a screen or involves a phone. And eventually that kind of creates this internal separateness within us that just makes us really unhappy.
You're talking about the importance of reconnection and like getting back to your younger self and your true self and doing things that you used to like doing as a kid. If somebody's listening to this or they're watching this and maybe they need to make more money in their life, maybe they need to work on their relationship with their partner, maybe they need to work on their health. If they like playing road hockey as a kid, they're doing that now, that's great, but that's not going to necessarily help them make more money or help them feel more motivated to reconnect with their spouse. Like outside of like getting grounded, kind of staying off of social media a bit, what are some other things somebody can do if they're feeling unmotivated to change something?
Yeah. I mean, it's a catch 22 because when you feel unmotivated, you don't really want to do anything. So that's the problem. And I think when you were saying like when you're playing road hockey, it's not going to make you connected. I think it does. I think when you're more connected to yourself, you're more open to your spouse. You're more open to sharing. And when we're not connected to ourselves, we become more closed. And the more closed we are, the more we kind of have that air of being closed. And people don't want to come and connect with us because we don't have that sense. And I think on a global stage, this is what's happening. Everyone's kind of withdrawn into themselves a little bit. And nobody's out there sort of making that first move to make the connection anymore because we're not happy. I know when I'm on vacation, like Cynthia and I just came back from Hawaii, you know, and she said, look, you know, you're so much happier. You know, not that I'm unhappy in general, which is not the case, but you know, when we were on vacation, like we were connecting, you know, we did all this sort of stuff. And then when you're here, you know, you're writing, you're, you know, doing podcasts and all that kind of stuff. And she says, I feel a little more separate from you. So I think when you're happier in general, I think you're just more connected. And the reverse is also true. When you're more sad or more upset in general, the more disconnected you are and the less likely you're going to be connected. So one of the ways of doing that is like, what do I want? Like, what makes me happy? And a lot of people have a hard time with that question because they haven't addressed it for so long. Like, what makes you happy? And finding like what used to make you happy and kind of slowly dipping your toe back into that again. Because I think when we're happier, we're more connected. When we're more sad, we're less connected. And both tend to exacerbate the same. So if you're happy, you're more likely to continue on being happy. If you're sad or anxious, you're more likely to continue on to being sad and anxious. So it does take an intention to change. It's not going to change on its own.
So would you say that the number one habit or skill somebody must develop in order to stay motivated, to be productive, to stay focused is paying attention to the connection to self and working on that?
You know, there's a saying that says your connection with other people can be no greater than your connection with yourself. And I believe that's true. I think that there's, you know, narcissistic people and that kind of thing that are very good at giving people what they perceive the other person needs. It's sort of a manipulative sense. But yeah, I mean, that sense of being connected with yourself, everything comes from that. You know, and I can tell you that from my own personal experience as well. That's how I got to the place where I wrote the book and that kind of thing. It was like, oh, I have this self connection. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's a happy connection. Like you can be connected to the sad parts of yourself. Like internal family systems work is a lot about this. Is like, you know, can you find the part of you that was like bullied or abused or neglected or abandoned when you were a child? Can you find that part? And that's not going to be fun. But, you know, if we have this separation from ourselves, whereas our adult self learns how to be you know, adapting to the situation, but really neglects the child in us that's still asking for our, to be seen, heard, loved, and protected, you know, eventually you're going to be unhappy. Eventually you're going to be separate. And I think this is why people commit suicide. I think this is why people get divorced, is that they lose the meaning in life. And they lose the meaning in life because they've lost the connection within themselves.
Morning routines have become super popular over the last decade. I think one of the main reasons is because it helps somebody allocate times for themselves. It helps people allocate time for themselves before the day gets started, before they got to take the kids to school, before they got to go to work, before they got to do X, Y, and Z. We talked about the importance of connecting to yourself through touch, breath, first thing in the morning when you wake up. We're talking now about some introspective stuff, and journaling can become very powerful when doing so. So as far as the morning routine goes, anything you would recommend somebody doing like every single morning to be able to stay connected to themselves so that they can be more motivated, focused, happier, et cetera?
Yeah. I mean, a simple one is, you know, this is a meditation that I kind of use when I've fallen out of meditation, because it's fairly easy to do. It's just sit yourself in a comfortable position, be in a quiet room or whatever, and then just count your breaths in and out. So I count to 50. So it's inhale 1, exhale 2, inhale 3, exhale 4. I don't say inhale, exhale, but I just say the numbers. And then the other thing that I do in that particular sort of meditation is that I elongate the space between the inhalation and the exhalation. So there is that break as you breathe out. There's a tiny little gap between when you start breathing in again and when you breathe in. There's a tiny little gap between when, and I just expand that gap just like an extra half of a second. And just that focus, it's an easy meditation to do. And you can start by doing 20, you know, or 10. You know, it's just a matter of just starting. You know, James Clear in Atomic Habits talks about that. Like, don't say I'm going to meditate and go, you know, try and sit down for 20 minutes because you're going to blow your brains out. Like, it's too much. And then you're going to develop an aversion to it and you're never going to want to do it again. So often I'll tell people, you know, just do 10, you know, inhale 1, 2 and do that. Start with that, get some success with that. And then start, because it's just slowing yourself down. Like, we go so quickly that I think this is one of the reasons why I think people say, you know, my life is just flying by, because I think we live in our heads and we live so quickly in our heads that we don't feel in our bodies. We don't feel the day. We don't feel anything because we're too busy trying to get to that next place where, you know, we might be able to have a drink or, you know, we can eat, like lunch is coming. Oh, lunch is 2 hours away. What am I going to do? So it is that building up that resilience to be okay with not having anything specific to soothe yourself. Can you just stay in that moment? Can you just stay in? And easier said than done. And I realize that it's not easy, especially if you're going through anxiety, depression, OCD, all that stuff. But it's just, you got to start somewhere.
If you were to give the audience 3 tips to reduce their overall stress in their life, other than some of the things that we've already covered, what would you say?
Well, the thing about stress is that you can either decrease your stressors or increase your resources. Those are your 2 options, right? And I don't think people think enough about increasing their resources. So, you know, self-touch, breath work, that kind of stuff. This increases your capacity and the resilience in your nervous system. So you can handle the amount of stress that you had yesterday, but you can handle it better because you have more resources. The other thing is, like, can you lower the stress? If you're constantly fighting with your spouse, can you get some counseling? Can you talk to them? Can you say, look, this is making me really unhappy. I'm sure it's making you unhappy too. What can we do to kind of lower our level of stress? So it's really, you know, increase resources or lower stressors, and just look, make a list of what are the stressors in my life. And can I, you know, sometimes, you know, you have 2 kids and they're kind of flying around the house. There's not a whole lot you can do in a way. But, you know, you can teach them meditation too. You can teach them breathing. You can teach them, you can, you know, do self-touch with them or put your hand on their chest and connect with them. Because when we soothe our kids, we have this natural soothing in ourselves. But if we're always running this peripatetic lifestyle where, you know, the kids are going to soccer and then they're going to band practice and they're going to this, like, it's just, there's no presence in that. And it's not like I'm like, oh, you have to live in presence. And that's, you know, it's not like that. It's basically just create, you know, more resources in your life and try and be intentional about the stressors that you do allow in there, rather than just unconsciously, you know, taking on more stuff. And a lot of us do that. I did that for a long, long time. Was if someone asked me if I could do something, I would just do it, you know? And then now I realize, okay, if I do this, I'm actually increasing my stresses and probably decreasing my resources, because the time that I would use to do this thing for this other person is taking away from the time that I would do something for myself. So it's really being aware. I think that big thing for me, this is from like David Rosmarin's book, Thriving with Anxiety, about you have to either decrease your stresses or increase your resources. And I think it's such a simple but valuable tool to just realize, make your stresses intentional, make your resources intentional. Because if you just sort of back your way through life, yeah, you're going to be stressed.
I want to go back to dopamine for a second. And as it relates to motivation and achieving things, and obviously making money, achieving goals, that sort of thing can be addictive and fleeting at times. And it's kind of like what you were talking about at the beginning, that we're in this like dopamine rat race, you know, in many ways. But talk about how somebody can have a healthy relationship with that. So let's just say that they're doing everything that we're talking about now, and now they're on this pursuit of wanting to achieve the thing, and they're on the process. How can they stay excited and motivated about what they're trying to achieve in a way that's sustainable?
Yeah, little goals. Like Andrew Huberman talks about that too, is like creating little goals along the way, rather than, you know, have everything piled into when I finally get this thing. You know, I often tell the story about when I got my medical degree, and as soon as they handed it to me, as soon as I felt the parchment paper of my MD degree in my hand, I was like, okay, what's next? What's next, right? There wasn't like, oh my God, this is such a miraculous achievement. This is amazing. It was like, okay, what's next? And I think that's a lot of our society, is that we think that when we get somewhere, like everything, our problems are going to just resolve. I mean, for me, even like I created a program called Your Mind Body Prescription for Permanent Anxiety Healing. There's 3,000 people in there. In 8 months, 9 months, it's made me close to $400,000. And I've never had this much money in my life. And for the first 2 or 3 weeks, it was freaking amazing. And now it's kind of like, oh, you know, it's just so human of us that we get into this thing where we think this is going to make things different. And, you know, I am not denigrating having like money to do stuff and that kind of thing too, because I know a lot of people don't. But it's just that old thing about like money's not going to make you happy, and wherever you go, there you are. You know, it's great. I think we need purpose. We definitely need purpose, which is, I think, an amazing thing for human beings to have purpose. But don't put too much emphasis on the outcome and the final, like getting it, because it may not be the thing that you think is going to sort of heal your life or fix your life. And can you make little rewards along the way? Like I have this whiteboard in my office. I wish I could show it to you. But basically, it's like it's pretty big. It's like 3x4. And every day I write stuff on it that I need to do. And that makes me feel better, because, you know, I'm not going to forget it, because like my little ADD brain forgets stuff all the time. So now I write it up there and I feel so much more comfortable. And then at the end of the day, what I used to do is as I finished the thing, I would erase them, right? And now what I do is I draw a line through them. So I see on the thing there's like 15 things with line. I mean, still got 5-10 other things I've got to do, but there's 15 things with lines through it. It's like, freaking did that, you know, like those things I accomplished. And I think those are like setting little goals for yourself. So I'm a big fan of these whiteboards, you know, put them up in your office and just write to even the smallest things, you know, like go to the gym, you know, call your daughter, whatever. Like when you get it, when you do it, you put a line through it, and then you look at the end of the day and it's like, man, I got a lot of stuff done today. Whereas, you know, 6 months ago, what I used to do is I would do a ton of stuff. And at the end of the day, I would go, I really don't know what I did today. Like, I really don't know what I got. I know I did some stuff, but and then now I have a real, like hardcore, like this is all the stuff that you got done. And it's like, you're doing pretty good.
I think one of the things people struggle with when it comes to the small goals is they don't know how to quantify it, right? Because we've been taught that goals are just these big things you got to achieve. You got to lose the 50 pounds. You got to have $1 million in the bank out of all these things. And so when they think about these mini goals, they're like, am I really playing big enough? Am I doing enough? How have you learned to quantify those for yourself so that it's not just manageable for you, but you're also like in a state of flow where you're still pushing yourself?
Yeah. I think that whiteboard that I was talking about, I think that gives me that sense that, okay, even the small things, like I'm getting stuff done. And I think a lot of us who are goal directed, we don't pay enough attention to the small stuff. We start looking for, you know, big validation, money, or, you know, awards or whatever it is. And those things are few and far between. But, you know, creating this sense, like, what did I do today? Who did I connect with today? That's another thing that I do. I try and just send a text to somebody that I scroll down in my text and see someone that I haven't texted for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, and say, hey, you know, I really appreciate you giving me advice on that. You know, 3 weeks ago, it's made a difference. And like just the connection, just creating those connections with other people, even if it's small, even if it's a little text message, like it really does change the, you know, this dopamine driven thing into this sort of serotonin. I did something nice for someone today. Like I really, and that's doing something for you. Like there is that sort of Buddhist concept that giving is actually getting. And I think the more generous we are with giving, you know, without exhausting ourselves, of course, the more we get.
You have an interesting background in that you're a neuroscientist, but you also have this side of you that understands trauma, spirituality, and stuff like that. And you mentioned like the money you were making. You're like, yeah, it was cool for a few weeks, but then it was like, on to the next thing, right? And people do that all the time. I'm wondering, I would love to get your thoughts on this, whether or not you think, is it a survival thing that it's like, I need to make more money because that's just what we're taught, or is it an ego thing?
Partly. I think it's partly, and I think it depends on how you were raised for sure. Like when I grew up, my brother and I and my family, we didn't have very much money. My dad was schizophrenic and bipolar, so he couldn't work. And he also liked to chain smoke as well. So packets of cigarettes, you know, cartons of cigarettes were expensive. So there was points where we would eat, you know, or we would drink powdered milk because we couldn't afford regular milk. So I think there is an element of lack in my money thing as well. There's also a sense of validation, making more money and that kind of thing. I think there's, to be honest, that's part of it, is just, you know, being in, as a general practitioner, I made a reasonable income. I made, you know, probably between $100,000 and $200,000 a year to me. And that was great, but it never really seemed to satisfy me. You know, I did a lot of travel. I did a lot of stuff with it. It wasn't like that I was feeling a lot of lack. But I think a lot of it for me is that sense that, you know, you're not going to be hungry again. Not that we were ever really like hungry or whatever, but there wasn't a whole lot of extras growing up. So, you know, and it's not like I feel like it's all going to get taken away from me and that kind of stuff too. But I think it depends on how you grew up. But what was your family's relationship with money? And how does that affect you today? So for me, I think the money partly is validation, is like I'm on the right track, I'm helping people. And the thing about my program is I priced it at $100. Like it's not like I'm selling this thing for $9.97 or something like that. Like I want it accessible to as many people. And my daughter works for me and she was saying, you know, there's people in Chile, there's people in Australia, there's people in India, there's people, you know, in Uruguay that are buying this program. It's like, and it warmed my heart to know that this is getting, you know, across the world. And that's why I priced it at $100, because it's less than the price of a therapy session. And people can actually really see what their anxiety truly is. And so for me, that validation is very, you know, life affirming for me. So I'm living my purpose for sure. And I think that's one of the things that, causes the most angst with people, is they feel like, well, I'm not living my purpose. I'm not living what I should do. And even as a medical doctor, I didn't feel like I was living my purpose. So now I do, you know. So I don't know if that's kind of a roundabout approach. I don't know what your original question was, Doug.
I was asking, like, if you think that people want more once they get the thing? Is it a survival thing or is it an ego thing?
I think it's both. You know, I think there, for me, it's definitely both. Like there's an element of survival, there's an element of ego, but there's also an altruistic element of like, I just love what I'm doing. And I love that I'm creating a different conversation about anxiety. I love that I'm creating something different that psychologists, psychiatrists, whatever can look at as a different model to use rather than this traditional model that's just what you think. You know, anxiety is just what you think, and it's not. It's basically, it's how you feel, and how you feel dictates what you think more than how you think dictates what you feel. And it's both. It's actually both. But what traditional therapy misses is that they miss this somatic role, this role of what we call interoception. The brain is always reading the body. And if the body has stress in it, the brain will create worries and stresses that are completely consistent with the stress in the body. And if you can learn how to release that stress in the body, the thoughts, the negative thoughts kind of fade away into the background because you actually treat the true root underlying cause of this as opposed to just trying to fix thoughts, which is basically just trying to, you know, shovel water out of a river. It doesn't work.
At the beginning, we talked about why people are feeling lost right now. And I think I heard you say something to the effect of people are feeling separated from others. They're feeling alone. They're feeling disconnected from themselves, separated from themselves. Talked about anxiety and the problems that can create if we're not kind of careful in how we navigate that. We've covered feeling lost, unmotivated. We've talked about why people don't achieve their goals, why people are unhappy. Do you think at the crux of this, the fundamental reason that people are feeling this way is their inability to deal with anxiety and regulate their nervous system?
Well, it's their inability to connect with themselves and connect with other people. And that's what's happening in a society, as a society, is that we're losing that goodwill that we have for other human beings, whether or not they look like us or not, whether or not they're white males or you know, BIPOC or whatever it is. Like we're losing that ability to just give credibility to other human beings for just being human beings. And I think that the more separate we become from other people, the more separate we naturally become from ourselves, which lends to, you know, dysphoria, anxiety, depression, all this kind of stuff. And we're seeing an increase in all of these things, including suicides, because people are just getting more and more separate from each other. And my mentor in developmental psychology, Dr. Gordon Neufeld, said this one thing that's always stuck with me is like, all anxiety is separation anxiety. And I add on there, and it's mostly separation from yourself. So the more connected we are, the happier we are. The more disconnected we are, the more us and them mentality we start to adopt. And this is what's happening in the States as far as politics. It's not so much about governing. It's just about making the other side look bad. Because we do get this little, you know, vasopressin dopamine rush from, you know, pecking down or hitting down on someone else. And unfortunately, it's like an addiction, but it's never satisfying. It's never satisfying to create an us and them mentality because ultimately you're separating from yourself, which is going to make you more unhappy, which is what's happening with society in general, is we're just getting more separate from each other.
I think talking about this more big picture, as far as being connected to ourselves and doing what we want in life and having autonomy and feeling like we're running our own race, we're not paying attention to others as much. How do you think somebody can know if they're living like a fully aligned life?
I think you just know. Like when you're aligned, you don't think about, you know, you don't think about living alive. It's like when people used to come into me in my practice and say, I'm worried that I'm getting Alzheimer's disease. And it's like, well, you know, the fact that you're worried about it, and they're worried about your memory, is probably a sign that you don't have it. Because the thing about Alzheimer's disease is that the memory starts to go and people don't notice it. So people around them notice, but they don't notice themselves. So it's kind of like when you direct attention to it yourself, you know, when you know that you're not feeling, you know, validated or mentally strong, what are you going to do about that? You know, typically what most of us do is kind of like the lazier way, which is get, you know, locked into our addictions and take short-term gratification. It's hard to actually do the big things. It's hard to start an exercise program. It's hard to stop eating sugar. It's hard to do these things. But I think, you know, when we make the intention that we're going to do it and we take it in small steps, like I said about the meditation, you know, just breathe in and out, count to 10, each breath in, one, out, two, and just do that for 5 days, and then pick it up to 20 and take it up to 50. You know, it's like little steps in connection with yourself, because the first leap is too much. It's too much to say, I'm just going to stop sugar altogether. Some people can do it. Or I'm going to stop my addictions altogether. I'm going to stop drinking altogether. It's like, it's really hard to sort of take that huge step. And if you can take it in incremental process, incremental steps, and all the while feel connected to yourself, self-touch, like breathing, like connected in your body, like really feel it, even if it's uncomfortable, like really allow yourself to stay with the emotion, stay with the feeling, then you start learning how to live. Otherwise, you're just basically kind of living in this dopamine-driven, peripatetic life.
How can somebody begin to identify what they want for themselves?
It's a tough question. You know, it's a really tough question, because I think for so long, we've looked for validation externally, and we lose the muscle of what do you need. And that's why I say, you know, what did you do when you were a kid? You know, did you draw? Did you dance? Did you?
I did drugs.
Okay, well, there you go.
No, I'm joking.
There you go. Get back into drugs. No. That's what you got to do, man.
I did, though.
My medical opinion.
Sorry, I'm just sorry.
Yeah, no, it's good. I like it. No, if you start getting, like Robin Williams was like that too, when he would come into the club that I worked at when he was filming a movie. And you could talk to Robin and he would have a conversation with you. But as soon as someone came in and cracked a joke, he was gone. So, you know, and I think that was his addiction. You know, his addiction was humor, because humor does make you feel better. You know, humor and tears, crying and laughter are not that far apart, believe it or not. In the nervous system. So both release a lot of like stress and trauma and that kind of thing. So laugh more. I mean, if you can go to a comedy club, you know, if you can find ways of activating that sort of parasympathetic nervous system through tears. You know, sometimes when stress builds up on me a lot, it's like I will watch videos of dog rescues, you know, dogs that are abandoned or chained up or whatever, and being rescued. And that brings me to tears and allows me to sort of, you know, move through that negativity. Because another thing Dr. Neufeld taught me is that, you know, tears are adaptive. You know, your wife is still leaving you, your pet has still died, but you change the internal structure of your brain. So your perception of those things isn't quite as bad. So tears don't change the external event, but they change your internal perception of the event. And I think that's why men commit suicide way more than women do, because we've taken tears away, which is a very helpful way of discharging negative emotion, but we've taken that away from men. So, you know, of course they commit suicide more. I mean, there's a number of reasons for that, but I think that's one of the ones to be considered, is that, you know, we take tears away from boys when they're very young, and tears are one of those things that help you adapt to a situation you cannot change.
You talked a few minutes ago about, you know, our idea of what we want in our life. A lot of it comes from the external, and then we have to really go within and come up with what we truly want in our lives. And you talked about going back to what we did as a kid, like in a tactical way. Do you think it's helpful for people to outline like things that they want in their life, morals, values, beliefs, or do you find that there's something else that might be a little bit more effective?
Yeah, everybody's different, you know, but I don't think it hurts to sort of write down, you know, what are the things that you want? And then just, because your writing brain is different than your speaking brain, right? So that's why I think journaling is so important to understand, is that, you know, we have this internal conversation with ourselves all the time, but that conversation may not ever be different. But when you start writing something down, your writing brain is different than your speaking brain. So you will see things that you will write that kind of surprise you, because it's not the typical thing that you converse with yourself in. And you will see things when you write it down that you won't see when you speak it out loud. So I think that's why journaling is really important. But it's just creating this sort of sense of quiet. Because, you know, you can't see what you want while the cacophony of, you know, life is around you. You know, you really have to take those and make the intention and realize that it may take you a month or two or longer to realize what you want. Because that muscle, like I said, has been atrophied from disuse for so long. You've been so used to looking externally for validation, dopamine, whatever it is, that we lose that ability to kind of just go inside and think, okay, what is it that I like? What makes me feel good? And what does make you feel good? You know, and if it's an addiction, well, you know, be careful of that. But if it's a connection with yourself or others, you know, give yourself more of that.
I feel like one of the traps people will fall into is they'll hear stuff like this and they're like, all right, I got to figure out a way to make my life perfect with my thoughts, my beliefs, like my anxiety, everything before I take a step in the right direction and try to like accomplish something in my life. And I think that one of the fastest ways to figure out what you want in life is to move forward and then by trial and tribulation, learn what you don't want in life. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's true. And I think it's especially true when you're younger, you know, like my youngest son, he's 20 now, just turned 20. And he's like, what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do with my life? And I always tell him, it's like, look, I didn't start back to school until I was 22, right? Like you still got some time to figure it out. Like I didn't become a doctor and I didn't start this whole, I was a bartender. I did all sorts of like different jobs before I went back to pre-med to become a physician. So it's really kind of getting into that quiet space with yourself. Like, what do you like to do? Like Michael likes to tinker with stuff. Like he likes to fix stuff. And it's like, so is there something in that realm, you know, that you might like to do? And he's kind of looking into like electrician or something like that. Like, what do you like? Like, look around you and see what your hobbies are like. See what the things that you like. Now, you may not be able to make a living at those things. Like, that's the thing. But if you do those things, you're much more likely to be able to start exercising the muscle of what you do want, as opposed to just like blindly kind of, oh, well, this profession might be good, or this profession will make me a lot of money, you know? And I see a lot of people, like I know a lot of people who are quite wealthy and extremely unhappy, you know? Now I'm selecting for people that want to, you know, talk to me, because that's kind of what I deal with is chronic sort of existential anxiety on some level. But it's just being quiet and developing that connection with yourself, because unless you have that, you're kind of fumbling around in the dark. And one of the reasons I became a doctor was because I'd never really felt like I was listened to as a child. So, you know, my dad took up a lot of the space in my house because of his mental illness. So one of the reasons I became a physician, and one of the reasons I do this, is probably because I you know, I'm heard, you know, people are listening to me. So we have these propensities in us for sure. Like I've always been a performer, even when I was a kid. So it was kind of like, okay, this is why I became a stand-up comic. This is why I became a doctor. This is why I became sort of, you know, on Instagram, is because I want to be heard. But there's part of me that's very quiet too, that doesn't really, you know, that looks at the part of me that sort of needs validation. It's like, well, you know, I think you just learn about yourself, you know, when you're quiet. You don't learn yourself about yourself when you're always running from place to place to place. I think you just become more of what's externally expected of you. And one of the things that I used to end some of my talks with is, be careful of what you're good at, because people will expect that from you, and then you will expect it from yourself. And it's very hard to get outside of that groove once you've, you know, lived in it for 10, 20, 30 years, but you can do it. I did it.
You know, a topic that often gets talked about when it comes to anxiety, stress, feeling lost, unmotivated, etc., is dealing with the unknown. How do we get better at that?
That's what anxiety is. Anxiety basically is uncertainty intolerance. That's what anxiety is. Like in one sentence, I could tell you that anxiety is basically being intolerant of uncertainty, probably because uncertainty was so painful for you as a child, right? So whenever we experience uncertainty as adults, it takes us back through the insula, through that period, that feeling in our body of being helpless, you know, being powerless. And we're not, you know, we're adults now. But the thing is, our brain doesn't know that. When you go back, when you regress, you know, one of my favorite sayings is, all emotional overreactions are age regressions. So when you see someone losing their, you know, they're in an age regression. And, you know, they become 8 years old. And then we get into partnerships when each of us are 8 years old fighting with the other, and 2 8-year-olds hammering it out aren't going to do well. So it's really understanding, like, how do you understand how you go about things? And can you become aware of, you know, are you an avoidant, you know, as far as your attachment style? Not that I'm huge on attachment styles, but it's certainly a nice metric. You know, are you avoidant in your relationships? You get close and then you're like, once you get too close, it's like, I can't do this anymore. Or are you anxious, where you're always chasing after someone else, right? And it's amazing how often the anxious and the avoidant match up with each other, right? They pair up. So it's just, but understanding yourself, like understanding, you know, what you need, like what's your go-to when you get stressed, what happens? And, you know, can you give yourself what you want from other people? Can you start doing that as opposed to expecting it from other people? And I was thinking about this morning is like, you know, this whole thing about self-care. And I think a lot of people, specifically with anxiety, depression, OCD, personality disorders, all this sort of stuff, they don't look after themselves because I think there is this subconscious drive in them that they think their parent is going to finally come back and they're finally going to do what they're supposed to do. And I think a lot of people don't look after themselves because of that. And consciously, they know it's ridiculous that the parent isn't coming back. But unconsciously, there's always that thing in us as children that we always, even as adults, the child in us is always kind of hoping that someone's going to come back and take care of us. And I'm here to tell you, nobody's coming to save you. It's up to you.
Dr. Russ, this has been awesome, super insightful conversation. I think a lot of people are going to get so much value out of this. If people want to connect with you, if they want to learn more about your work, if they want to buy your book, where's the best place to do that?
Probably my website. Like all my stuff is The Anxiety MD, not The Anxiety Doctor, but The Anxiety MD. So Instagram at The Anxiety MD. My website is The Anxiety MD. Everything is The Anxiety MD. It's pretty easy to find me. I'm kind of all over the internet these days.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much once again for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it. Audience is going to really enjoy this one.
Thanks, Doug. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Sounds good.